Well, as we've been hearing, there have been outpourings of grief in India following the death of one of the country's most loved, most influential and most colourful politicians, Jayalalitha Jayaraman. The 68-year-old chief minister of the state of Tamil Nadu died of a heart attack earlier this week. She's been called in the past the Iron Lady of Indian politics, and she's also been accused of corruption, but she gained mass support and massive support for her populist and pro-poor schemes. She was also the first state minister to unveil an action plan for curbing sexual offences against women. This was back in 2013. And that is an issue close to the heart of high-profile Indian journalist Barker Dutt. She is the host of India's longest-running talk show, We the People. She's also consulting editor for NDTV News Network. And she's here in Australia joining us from Melbourne this morning. Barker Dutt, welcome to RN Breakfast.
Thank you, Fran. It's a pleasure to be on.
Now, you've met Jayalalitha Jayaraman. The last time was in 2011. I think you interviewed her. Tell us a little bit about her. What was it about her that made her such an iconic and popular figure?
Well, Fran, nothing that I could say would even begin to explain to your listeners why she kind of had the cult following that she did. In fact, ever since she died, and she's died from natural causes, from an illness, it's not as if, you know, she's had a violent death or a contentious death. We have seen lakhs and lakhs of people, this kind of mass hysterical outpouring. But even when she was alive, you know, the people in her party, even her colleagues, would often carry photographs of her in the pockets of their shirts. They would prostrate themselves flat at her feet. She was often known as Amma, which is the colloquial word for mother. What I think really defines her is a woman breaking through the glass barriers in a world that continues to be male dominated, which is the political stratosphere of India. What is fascinating, despite all the controversies around her, and there were many, including allegations of corruption, was that she managed to run a state with the fewest recorded crimes against women. And I don't think I have seen these many female voters, female supporters actually out on the streets. Normally, the kind of people who come out on the streets are men. It's a male-dominated context. And therefore, I think this was really a very, very interesting breakthrough woman leader who, as controversial as she was also formidable.
Yes, and just to remind or tell people a few of the controversies a lot of people here wouldn't know. She was convicted of misusing her office to amass properties worth over $10 million. She was implicated in a coal import scam. And she was criticised for the lavish wedding she hosted for her son. I think the event holds the Guinness World Record for the most guests at a wedding and the largest. You know, you'd think that some of the poorer amongst the province might have marked her down against that, but they didn't. And I think that's a very interesting point you make about women holding her up and coming out to support her.
You know, and that was, it was her foster son. And there were so many other ways that she was completely enigmatic, because the fact of the matter is that when I travel in the West, I find that when women politicians do need to make it big, and I've seen this especially in the American context, they need this kind of perfect family portrait. They need the husband, the two children, the dog, right? It needs to be that perfect little pretty picture of a family. Actually, Jayalalitha was effectively a single woman. Her mentor in politics is somebody she's believed to have had a relationship with, who died much earlier. Her constant confidant was a female companion. That relationship was presented as a close friendship. Nobody really knows, you know, beyond that, why they were so close. But the fact is that she was effectively a single woman. She was a single woman who made personal choices on her own terms, who never really got married in that conventional sense, was not able to offer that that picture of domesticity that is often demanded of women before they're accepted by a large following, especially in, in societies as conservative is the one I come from. And I just find it really interesting in the context of, you know, if you look at this in the larger context of a Hillary Clinton defeat, where the Americans are still debating when they'll have a woman leading their country, coming from a country that the West would often brand as orthodox, I think we've done a little better with our women politicians.
And she was brave. As you say, she introduced that action plan, a 13-point action plan to ensure the safety of women in Tamil Nadu. And from what you've just said, it seems as though it is having an impact. Though nationally, the official figures in India in terms of rape and sexual assault are horrendous. 34,000 cases of rape reported in 2015. Many more cases suggested would go unreported. Sexual assault remains a huge problem in India, despite the spotlight that was shone on it just a few years ago when that Delhi student, Jyoti Singh, was beaten, gang-raped and tortured so badly she died from her injuries. It really shocked the world, that case.
Yes. I think you would agree, Fran, that that this is a universal phenomenon and sure. societies are battling this with varying degrees of success around the world. Sexual violence against women, abuse, and sexual violence sometimes takes an overt form of physical assault, but in many other ways there are abusive relationships that women inhabit, where they take years to actually recognize the abuse that they're facing. And one of the interesting statistics that I can share with you is that more than 90% of women in India actually know the man who's abused them. And I always say that while it's easy to get all outraged about the abuse out there on the street and make the image of the abusive man in your head to be the stranger, yes. actually what's really frightening is that quite often, and more often than not, it is happening within the circle of trust, right?
And that's a universal problem, as you say. We have that same statistic here, and we have yes. a very animated, vigorous debate about this at the moment in terms of family violence. For you, you have told your told the mm-hmm. world, really, in your book, mm-hmm. The Unquiet Land, Stories from India's Fault Lines, that you have personal experience of this. Mm-hmm. So you have an understanding of this, that it's not stranger danger, so to speak.
Well, you know, when I was writing a book on India, and it was really a difficult choice for me. Do I share my own story, which I never had till that moment of experiencing sexual abuse as a child who was not yet 10, from a relative, in fact. And so, as you said, it does happen within the circle of trust. It happens with people you actually trust and feel safe with till you realize what's happening. And the reason that I went public with my story is because I believe that I've always spoken as a journalist about breaking the silence, lifting the veil of I think it's a conspiracy of silence. I think women are made to feel stigmatized. Women are made to feel it's their fault somehow, right? Instead of shaming those who do it, we make women and children feel the shame. And I thought that if all my life I had held the position that women must speak, then I must lead by example by speaking first. And two, as someone who's reasonably in the public space, is recognized, is followed. I had hoped that my example of writing about a relative basically sexually abusing me when I was a child would help other people speak. And that is why I put that very personal story in the book, including talking about how things like this actually change you in ways that you continue to discover. I'm 45 now, and you continue to discover that you carry it with you no matter how old you get.
It's 23 past 8. Our guest is journalist, Indian journalist Baka Dutt. And I wonder if you feel it did make a difference. I was really shocked when we heard a news report here in Australia a little while ago in October. Al Jazeera was reporting that videos with footage of women being raped were being sold across the state of Uttar Pradesh, costing 30 yes. cents to $3, made to blackmail yes. the victim, stop reporting the crime to police. I mean, a horrendous thing. And it's not only India, of course, mm-hmm. that has these sorts of horrible things occur. But when that became public, was there widespread condemnation of that in your country?
I'll tell you what's changed. I think you're right in saying that we're so far from, you know, being able to say that a woman isn't raped twice over, one when she's actually raped and second when the shame is actually foisted on her, when the shame should be that of a perpetrator. But what has changed in the 20 years that I've been a journalist is that gender used to belong to the inside pages of newspapers. It was considered a soft story for women reporters to cover. It was never the lead. It was never considered hard news. I think the Delhi gang rape that became a global story, where you saw mass protests on the street, finally led to the mainstream of the gender conversation. It's finally something that people are willing to talk about, that politicians are held accountable on, that it's no longer easy, for example, for a politician to talk loosely about women and not be held to task. Yes. So, you know, I just wrote a recent column saying that with all the inequities of my country, I don't know that a person who spoke about women as Donald Trump did would be able to run for the highest political office. So we're a paradoxical country, right? We are a deeply unequal country in some ways. We kill our girls before they're born, but yet we've had women prime ministers and we've had women leaders in key positions. Mm. We continue to be unequal in other ways. We continue to shy away from, I don't know how it is in Australia, but for example, one of the big debates in India is on marital rape. We don't yet have a law that recognizes marital rape. So basically, marriage is almost treated as a license to rape, if you will.
Yeah.
And when this came to India's parliament, we had very conservative pushback with people saying this was going to increase the rate of divorce and so on, with many of us saying what kind of marriage was worth preserving if there was violence and sexual abuse in it. But those are the kind of things we continue to face pushback on. And yet in other ways, you have women and men, I would say, with a greater feminist sensibility than ever before, able to be more outspoken than they could 2 decades ago.
And this is terrific talking to you, Barker. It's fantastic to get this perspective sort of here in Australia, because we look from afar so often. Mm-hmm. Can I come back and ask you finally then about the relationship between India and Australia and the perception of Australia? Because the death of the Brisbane bus driver, Manmeet, yes, Alisher, back in October, it obviously got wide coverage in India. I think, yes, you covered it well on your program. He was a, yes, popular member of the Indian community here in Australia, and he was killed when a device similar to a Molotov cocktail was, mm-hmm, thrown inside his bus. Police say there was no evidence this was a hate crime, but the family did suspect it was racially motivated, this killing. What's been the response to India to that?
Well, quite honestly, I mean, it was a horrific incident that really made big headlines back home in India. And most people I know did perceive it to be a hate crime against the backdrop of a huge debate a few years ago, I think around 2010, over whether Indians who live in Australia are at the receiving end of racism. I think things have got a lot better now in terms of where that debate settles. I know there are more than 400,000 Indians or people of Indian origin in Australia. It has clearly not stopped Indians from coming here. But yes, I would say that the Brisbane bus driver and the horror, the fact that he was burnt alive, does bring home questions that I think societies all over the world are dealing with. That, mm-hmm, as countries watch their demographics change, as they become more diverse in a way that they were not prepared for, as economic fault lines and class divisions play to other kinds of subliminal prejudices, there is the whole insider-outsider debate. And I think Indians feel they go through that to an extent. Here on the geopolitical thing, on the geopolitical front, I think there's a sense. I was just here attending a big Australia-India conference, and what I heard a lot of from Australians was how uncertain they feel the post-Donald Trump world might be for them. How we are now living in an age where strategic conversations are shifting to the Indo-Pacific. How the China factor may bring Australia in India closer in ways, yep, that they had not anticipated. So I think these are uncertain times. In fact, I remember a friend at this conference saying even the Cold War had more predictability.
Barker Dutt, on that note, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Fran. It's a pleasure being on.
Barker Dutt is a journalist, one of the highest profile journalists in India. She's host of the longest running talk show, We the People. She's also the author of This Unquiet Land, Stories from India's Fault Lines. And she's here for the Australia-India Leadership Dialogue. It's 28 past 8 on Breakfast.
From the founder of Apple to comedian Andy Samberg, from the head of Netflix to the man who built the World Wide Web, from the creators of the record-breaking podcast Serial to startups that are breaking ground right here in Australia, if you want to hear from the movers and the shakers, media, technology and culture around Australia and the globe, there is literally one show. It also happens to be the most literally named show. Download this show with me, Mark Fennell, media, technology, culture. Find it on the RN website now or on the ABC Radio app.